Hello and welcome to CSDS Asia Matters, the podcast where we aim to take you behind the headlines to discuss the most important stories shaping the world's most interesting region. I'm Andrew People. For this episode, we're doing something a little different. I've come to Brussels, where our partners, the Centre for Security, Diplomacy and Strategy at the Brussels School of Governance, are hosting their first ever Indo-Pacific Forum. It's a real opportunity for experts and policymakers from across both Europe and countries in the vast Indo-Pacific region to come together to talk about some really important issues. So we started with a session on the geopolitical landscape, in particular the US-China rivalry and how countries in the Indo-Pacific are responding and what Europe's role in all of that might be. We've had another session on the major security and defense trends taking place in the region, and lastly one on the quickly changing landscape of technology and supply chains. Well, to give you a flavor of the event, we've asked experts from each of the panels to talk to us about the issues they've been discussing and to share some of their insights. Well, I'm joined now by Professor Yuichi Hosoya. Hosoya-san is the Professor of International Relations at Keio University, one of Japan's most prestigious universities, of course. Thank you so much for joining us. You've just been on a panel speaking with other guests about security and defense trends in the Indo-Pacific out until around 2030, a nice period to look at just over the medium term. What sort of themes are you looking out for over that period in terms of security in the Indo-Pacific region?
I feel that we are now seeing the structural confrontation between the United States and China. And of course, this confrontation or the relationship will define the future course of the region. So the summit meeting between President Xi and President Biden can mitigate the tension between the two sides, but at the same time, we basically predict that the confrontation continues relating to some of the strategic documents which the United States government has already published. In the sense, we have to prepare for the continuation of the structural confrontation between the two superpowers, of course, the United States and China. The other point is Taiwan. Further, the current trends in the war in Ukraine will link to the crisis in Taiwan Strait, because now we are seeing the return of the power politics in global affairs. So power is becoming more important, particularly nuclear weapons are becoming more important than before, in the sense those tensions can easily spread to Taiwan, in the sense one of the most important questions which are now seeing is whether China is trying to unify the country with the use of force, as Chinese leaders often mentioned before.
You mentioned Taiwan there. From a Western perspective, of course, and here we are in Brussels today, the main threat to security in the near term in the Indo-Pacific region would usually be seen as being a conflict over Taiwan someday. Is that perspective shared amongst countries in the region like Japan? And what other flashpoints should we be monitoring in that period out to around 2030?
Interestingly, if we go farther from Taiwan, like in Washington, D.C., or in some of the European countries, we see some of the really pressing concerns over the future crisis or war or conflict in Taiwan. But in Japan and in Taiwan, we usually do not expect that China would be willing to invade Taiwan militarily, because China basically prefers much more indirect ways to unify Taiwan. It's clear that China is willing to unify Taiwan by using the threat of force. But on the other hand, if China attacked Taiwan, it would have a serious, devastating effect upon Chinese economy as well. So that's why we usually expect that China prefers basically much more indirect means, such as using influence operation in Taiwan by trying to attract nationalist party members to try to be closer to China. While majority of Taiwanese people are hating to be a part of China, much more than before, in the sense China is now facing a really serious problem. Younger Taiwanese are now trying to take a much bigger distance from Beijing's position. So China is not at Beijing's side, but at the same time, China basically doesn't like perhaps to use its military muscle to unify the country. So if something happened in Taiwan, like a declaration of independence or something, if the United States or Japan or Taiwan try to provoke China, maybe China will have a good reason to do something new. But unless we do something new like this, I think that China maintains some of the quite reactive position to this question of the unification of Taiwan.
What other flashpoints would you say there are to look out for then? I guess there's obviously the perennial problem of North Korea, but anything else that is on your radar in the coming years?
Yeah, North Korea is another issue because unlike before, a decade or two before, we were seeing the collaboration and the cooperation among the six powers. Six powers means that United States, Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, North Korea. But we have been trying to solve that crisis. But now we are seeing much more structural or ideological confrontation between the two groups. On one hand, we see the cooperation among liberal democracy, but on the other hand, we see the cooperation among authoritarian regimes. We should say that North Korea can develop nuclear weapons much more easily than before without strong criticism coming from either Beijing or Moscow, because they are helping North Korea in confronting the United States or other like-minded democracies. So because of this structural divide between the two groups, maybe North Korea or some other areas as well, it is more difficult to solve these questions based upon the concert among great powers. So this is a new trend of the flashpoint in the region.
How would you assess the current balance of power in the region? I mean, obviously the Indo-Pacific is a large area, but within that, do you see any particular country or grouping of countries becoming a dominant force in the region? And how do you see that potentially changing in the near to medium term?
Well, the speed of Chinese military build-up or Chinese military modernization has been much faster than we originally expected. So that's why Japan or United States or any other country like Australia, they share serious great concern over the strategic change in the balance of power of the region. That's why the Quad is now playing an important role, because China would be much more willing to drastically change the power balance in the region. In the sense, we need more collaboration in responding to strengthen deterrence against Chinese, well, quite aggressive behavior there. So in the sense, maybe Japan needs to strengthen its strategic cooperation or security cooperation with like-minded countries like United Kingdom, France, Germany, EU, NATO, together with Japan's Quad collaboration among the four democracies. So we need these kind of security collaboration much more than before because of the speed of Chinese military build-up, which radically changed the balance of power. In the sense, many security experts as well as officials within the US government are now predicting that the US-Japan alliance would lose the regional conflict there, because it takes 2-3 weeks for the United States to gather its sufficient military power to respond to Chinese aggression. In a sense, we are in a serious danger of seeing radical change in strategic balance in the region.
That's very interesting. I mean, you referred to the Quad there. We've also seen in recent years the development of things like AUKUS, the alliance between Australia, the UK, and the US. And obviously, the region, as you know, is home to various different trade arrangements and so on. Do you see any possibility of the emergence of broader-based alliances then, along the lines of NATO, as you referred to? If not, how do you see those alliances developing?
The encirclement of China by Asia and NATO is that the biggest thing that Chinese government really hates to see. But at the same time, even though we need solidarity among like-minded democracies, it is quite difficult for us to create such Asian NATO, because we need to maintain flexibility in having those security cooperation. Because if we have Asian NATO, some conflict would easily trigger a full-scale war between the United States and China. We need to maintain some flexibility because each country has different strategic interests, and a degree of sharing common interests and values are much lower than the degree of solidarity among European countries within the NATO. In the sense, I prefer maintaining those kind of flexible collection of those security collaboration or cooperation in the region, rather than creating Asia NATO, which would radically threaten Chinese vital security interests.
You've referred a couple of times to the risk of provoking China somehow, whether it's Taiwan declaring independence or, as you say, the creation of an Asian NATO. How, in more broadly, do countries like Japan balance their security needs in the coming years with the fact that they don't want to antagonize China too much and disrupt their own economies? After all, countries like Japan have very deep trade and investment relationships that are important with China now.
From a civilizational point of view, Chinese government and leaders basically hate current global order because they think that the current global order, international order, was basically created by Western power. That's why they're trying to find some reason to radically reform, in their words, democratize global order by adding much more Chinese interests and values there. It means that the global order will be much more directed by authoritarian ideologies. We need to maintain some of the important liberal values like freedom and human rights, rule of law, and so on, which, to some extent, Chinese government don't like to see. So basically, I feel that China is quite a reactive country. China is trying to find out some reason to radically reform or revise the current international order. So the point is, we should not provide China to have those legitimate reasons from their point of view to reform or revise drastically the current international order, because they have power to do that, but they don't have sufficient legitimacy to radically reform the current order. So that's why China is now attracting so-called global south to be side with China. It's a kind of a battle for the hearts and minds of people, particularly in the global south. In a sense, liberal democracy must be attractive to those countries as well. Otherwise, we will lose that.
Professor Hosoya, thank you so much for your time and thank you for those insights. Absolutely fascinating, and it's been great to talk to you today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Yunjung Choi. Yunjung is the Director of IP Studies at the Sejong Institute in Korea, and she's been talking on a panel, a very interesting panel, about the effect that we're going to see on global supply chains, on technology and partnerships between countries in the coming years. Yunjung, thank you so much for joining us. I wondered if I could talk about some of the points that came up during the panel. The system of global supply chains that really developed in the last part of the 20th century has really been challenged in the last few years, both by COVID, obviously, and the tensions between the US and China and other geopolitical tensions in the world. What do you see as the main trends we're going to see in supply chains over the medium term, out to around 2030, say?
Okay, for the global value chains, As you know, the free trade order that we are having today was established by the U.S. after the Second World War II. And it was a kind of process where the world was being homogenized and the chain of production and sales spread all over the world in search of efficiency, or in other words, utility maximization. But the current trend is the opposite. It is becoming an era where competition between supply chains, not free trade. So new kind of qualification or conditions to join these supply chains are evolving, and which are the capabilities or values of each country have. And we are witnessing a burst of various supply chain consultative bodies, such as Supply Chain Resilience Initiative, or Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or ITUT. And all these supply chain consultative bodies are expected to gradually increase. We see an increase in the number of consultative bodies, but also an increasing tendency to consult on an agenda basis. So we are going to witness a burst of a greater number of supply chain consultative bodies over the medium term, to 2030. However, problems are already being raised about the efficiency of the supply chain. And there are many countries which are excluded from participating in the supply chain. Therefore, I believe that efforts to ultimately restore an efficient multilateral system will and should be made at the same time.
You think there will be more of a breakdown in supply chains, essentially. Do you think inevitably we'll see more of a split between regions in the realm of technology? You're obviously in Korea, absolutely vital to global supply chains, particularly in the chip industry. But do you think, for example, in approaches to data, the internet, and other physical infrastructure, we're going to see different sort of worlds emerge, maybe based around China and the US, for example?
So as you rightly point out, we're witnessing the West and its allies and partners exclude China from the tech area, including 5G, semiconductor, batteries, and so on. And as long as there is a perception that defines China as a systematic competitor or rival, this trend will continue. In accordance with the perception that this trend will continue and even deepen, regional countries such as ASEAN and India are responding to the call of the United States, despite their huge trade dependence on China. However, at the same time, China itself is also pursuing a state-led industrialization policy, such as Made in China 2025. And in this process, China will constantly try to lure the weak links of the West Bloc. And emerging developing countries that still expect benefits from both sides, from the US and from the China, will become a swing state and play a role in blurring the boundaries. In reality, it is true that the propaganda and practical investment proposed by China are very attractive to regional countries that have difficulty meeting the high standards demanded by the West. As these trends appear to be mixed, growing tendency to a split will be observed, but not mixed, and is going to be a very mixed and blurred way. So this will be the crucial difference from the Cold War in the past. For instance, if you look at the data, currently there is no consensus in the international community, no global regime on the cross-border movement of data. Digital powerhouses are establishing their own digital trade order. While the WTO does not provide any universal guidelines, this discussion is being conducted on several levels, bilateral, multilateral, or multilateral PTAs, such as the Korea-US FTA, CPTPP, or even in IPEF. So yes, we are going to see a more split, but it's going to be kind of, you know, a different way that we are expecting now.
We're here in Europe today, obviously, and Europe often seeks to portray itself as having an important role in all of this, in the setting of global regulation and standards, in areas such as technology. Is that view of Europe's role shared in countries across the Indo-Pacific? And what more can be done to try and ensure the development of globally accepted and enforced standards, do you think?
Regional countries are also clearly aware that the EU is expanding its interest and role in the Indo-Pacific. And most countries, I think, are really welcoming, and they're expecting more from European partners to have their more active involvement in the region. I can say it is widely acknowledged that Europe has taken the leadership role in making the global norms and rules. But again, this has pros and cons in the countries in the Indo-Pacific. For the positive side, this is why the Singaporean think tank ISES, its survey results show that EU is one of the most trustworthy partner countries for the ASEAN. It is true that many experts in the region regard EU's engagement in the region will help enhance and enrich the rule-based order. Regarding the field of science and technology, an era of competition for technology supremacy has already arrived between the US and China. But still, there is no proper body for technical cooperation in which developing countries in the region can participate in, and therefore, it is difficult to discuss globally accepted and enforced standards, as I mentioned before. However, in this situation, I think the EU will be able to demonstrate its norm-setting power again. For example, as you know, the EU launched a new Horizon Europe in 2021. The Horizon Europe aims for open science. It can provide a platform suitable for promoting scientific cooperation with Indo-Pacific countries in fields such as engineering and technology, medical and health sciences. For example, in the field of mobile communication, international cooperation that uses open radio access networks that are not dependent on any specific companies, such as Open Radio Access Network and Open RAN, or Open RAN, is an example that can minimize security considerations in technology and activate participation of developing countries.
Just one last question then. The panel that you talked on today included a discussion of digital partnerships, and the EU is very keen to talk about the digital partnerships that it's forming, particularly in Asia. What do we mean actually by that term? What do these digital partnerships really mean? And do you think more such arrangements are needed? And if so, where?
I think digital partnership can have many connotations. But one thing that we have to, make sure is that nowadays, various digital trade regimes are evolving and competing with each other. But digital transformation is a task that cannot be, delayed anymore. In order to realize digital partnership in the Indo-Pacific region in such a situation where we don't have any shared or standardized norms, it is required to first classify what is the level of digital development and what is the real needs from the countries in the region in terms of digital partnership. Then it is necessary to divide countries into different groups. The groups which we have to focus on basic digital literacy or infrastructure, from groups where we have to target a advanced cooperation in the field of cybersecurity and data safety issues. So these kind of very tailored and very sensitive approach should be made when you think of having digital partnership in the countries. And again, these developing countries in the Pacific recognize the opportunities of digital norms, but hope that the interests of the regional countries are addressed. The establishment of a new digital order and the spread of digital innovation reflecting the interests of regional countries will be a very good initiative where EU can stand out as the most practical cooperative partners in the Indo-Pacific. For example, in the emerging economies of Indo-Pacific, the share of small and medium-sized enterprises is much more than 90%. So their digital partnership will reconnect the region with the world and create a driving force for economic growth. And for the EU, EU is connected to the vibrant dynamic market of the Indo-Pacific. EU will be able to gain a strong growth engine again. And digital cooperation is also an important part of digital partnership in the Indo-Pacific region. Empowerment of SMEs and women, vaccine diplomacy, and so on are priorities of regional countries. So it can be said that it is a very promising cooperation agenda. Besides digital partnership, we can think of another area where the agreements such as digital partnership is needed, climate change. The Paris Agreement, as you know, is requiring reduction targets to be submitted to the UN through nationally determined contributions. But each country has submitted very ambitious their own NDCs. But the problem is that, unlike the EU, many developing countries that joined late have to make much more, you know, condensed efforts in a short period of time to achieve their goals, and they may have many technical difficulties. The Indo-Pacific is one of the regions most affected by climate change, as you know. So therefore, if we can promote the net zero partnership with the EU, the Indo-Pacific region will be the region that benefits the most. So I think this is a really promising area that we have to, you know, focus on.
That's a really important point, and thank you for talking about climate change as well. I think that's going to be a vital area, as you mentioned. Yunjung, thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for taking part in the podcast. It's been really great to talk to you. Thank you. So joining me now is Richard Tibbles. Richard is the EU's Special Envoy for the Indo-Pacific at the European External Action Service, which is effectively the EU's diplomatic service. Richard's just been speaking at a panel. It's been about the broader macro geopolitical picture around the Indo-Pacific and the EU's role in that. And Richard, if you don't mind, I'd like to follow up with a few questions based on the themes of what you guys were all talking about. Just to begin with, there's a sort of common perception, isn't there, that the US and China are competing for political, economic, and even military power in the Indo-Pacific. So where does the European Union fit into all of this? And is that how you see things from the European perspective?
Thanks very much, Andrew. Well, we are keen to contribute to stability and prosperity across the region. So we do not wish to feed a bipolarized world. We want to work with all countries of the Indo-Pacific partners to enhance their own choices, just as we in the EU are looking to strengthen our strategic autonomy and reinforce diversified supply chains. So we think our Indo-Pacific partners are also looking for more margin of maneuver in their relations with other partners. So we want to support that. This doesn't mean in any way that we're equidistant between the US and China. It's quite clear that Brussels is much closer to Washington, not just geographically, but very much so politically as well. So therefore, we will also work with like-minded partners wherever we can to ensure that the Indo-Pacific remains an open, free, and inclusive area where stability and prosperity can prosper.
What's the EU's interest then in the Indo-Pacific? Is engagement with the region, is it primarily about trade and investment links? Could the Europe, for example, ever join something like the CPTPP, the big trade deal that unites so many of the countries in the region?
Trade investment is obviously very important, and the EU has a comparative advantage in being able to conclude free trade agreements with our partners. We have concluded four with Indo-Pacific partners already, and we're negotiating a set of others as well. And we're also looking to work with our partners to build, as I said, diversified value chains. For example, we're looking step up our partnership with Australia in terms of critical raw materials. But it's not just about trade and investment. We also have a very, very clear interest in peace and security, and we'll step up our contribution in that area. We are now extending the concept of coordinated maritime presence to the northwest Indian Ocean to ensure that European naval vessels are in that part of the Indo-Pacific region at all times. We are also working through our project Crimario to step up our cooperation with partners in the area of maritime domain awareness as well.
Can you just explain what Crimario is for our listeners?
That is critical maritime routes in the Indo-Pacific region.
Right.
So that's an EU-funded project which has developed this platform for sharing information between different services, agencies involved in our partner countries with maritime domain awareness. So we're active in the security field as well. And thirdly, obviously, we have a particular strong suit when it comes to the green and digital transition, since this is such an important area for the EU27, the EU and its member states as well, that we are looking to work with our partner countries very intensively in those areas. We have a project with our Pacific partners called the Green Blue Alliance, where we're looking to help them deal with the existential issue of climate change. And we are developing digital partnerships. We have one with Japan for several months. Yesterday, we finalized the one with Korea. We're looking to complete with Singapore very, very soon. On your question about the CPTPP, I think our view is that we have a network, or we have in place, or we are negotiating a network of free trade agreements, which effectively covers all CTPP countries. So for us, we do question whether there is added value from our perspective of joining that, given the complications, given the consensus needed amongst the members of CTPP, difficulty in negotiating market access with each of them, and one shouldn't overlook that there are differences between our approach in free trade areas and in the CTPP, whether it comes to trade and sustainable development, geographical indicators, investment or data protection, digital trade, for example. So for us, we believe our network of FTAs is the right way to go.
I'm interested in your comments on security. I mean, skeptics might say that Europe can't really play a major role in the Indo-Pacific if it doesn't have the sort of military and particularly naval strength that the US and China both have in the region. So what could you give a bit more detail on what the EU actually has to offer on the security front if it simply doesn't have the ships and the manpower that those two big superpowers have?
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the non-security factors in contributing to stability in the region. The fact that we are a single market of 500 million plus well-off consumers is attractive to our partners. The fact that we are the major development partner in the region is significant. We are a standard setter across many areas, and we are a leader on the green transition and climate action. So, I don't think one should regard those areas where we have a strong suit as being completely separate from the security area. They do contribute to stability. The second thing I wanted to say was that I think many potentially have been surprised by the strength and unity of EU action in relation to Ukraine. Our like-minded friends in the Indo-Pacific region have looked at this very positively as a sign of EU leadership and geopolitical awakening. And those who maybe don't share our views showed a grudging respect towards our actions. So our actions in defense of international law and international rules-based order with regard to Russia and Ukraine send a message to our Indo-Pacific partners of the role that we can play. Then more explicit, more specifically, what we are doing, as I mentioned already, is to ensure constant naval presence in the Northwest Indian Ocean. We are expanding our cooperation under the Prunario project that I've already mentioned. And finally, we are also using our project, which is called Enhancing Security in and with Asia, which is effectively contributing to capacity building in our partner countries in the security area, whether it's counterterrorism, crisis management, cyber, or maritime security.
I wanted to ask a broader question about your role and your role dealing with the Indo-Pacific. I mean, it's a relatively new term in geopolitics, and I wondered whether you could tell us a bit about who you see as the key stakeholders in the region, who you actually engage with. I mean, it's not a unified area in the same way as the EU itself is, for example. So how does this actually work in practice? We talk about the Indo-Pacific, but it's not really you can't just sort of knock on the door and say, hello, Indo-Pacific, we're here.
Well, we've identified the 7 priority areas for cooperation with Indo-Pacific partners in our strategy of last year. And for us, all partners are important. We can't ignore any country. But that doesn't mean we do the same thing with Japan as we do with Laos, for example. So we will tailor make our cooperation to our mutual interests, our interests and the interests of the partner country. And that goes for regional organizations as well. What we do with ASEAN will be different from what we do with the Pacific Island states, for example. So there is a menu of possibilities, and we are exploring with our partner countries, each of them, where we can best work together. Having said that, many of the challenges are the same for all of them, whether it's secure lines of communication, diversified value chains, preparing our economies and societies for the green and digital transition. So there are a number of common threats, I think, which are relevant for all countries of the Indo-Pacific, notwithstanding our intention to work where it's in our mutual interests. And we will listen. I think this is one of the important messages that I picked up since starting on the 1st of September. It's that we have to listen to our Indo-Pacific partners and take their views very much into account.
And last question, Richard, if I may. You mentioned the Ukraine conflict and the sort of grudging respect, I think was your term, that some partners in the region have given to Europe for its response. But is there a concern, do you pick up a concern at all from any of the countries that Europe will just be completely distracted by the Ukraine conflict for the foreseeable future and will sort of neglect these areas of progress with the Indo-Pacific countries?
I think there is that fear there, and the High Representative at the conference this morning clearly stated that this should not and will not happen, that we will remain engaged in the Indo-Pacific, because you cannot divide the world into different boxes now. The challenges to security in Europe have a knock-on effect in the Indo-Pacific and vice versa. So we will stay very much determined to build on the implementation of our Indo-Pacific strategy and work with all partners to hopefully build secure, stable and prosperous future for us all.
Richard, thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for those comments. Much appreciated.